Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's Bible-based lecture, where Mr. Judah Hunter is going to speak to us to the title, Alexander the Great, Prophesied in the Bible. To introduce tonight's lecture, we've been asked that to introduce it, we'll read from Daniel chapter 8. Reading Daniel chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Uli. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came up from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, and toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host, and one of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And it came to pass, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, and sought for the meaning, then, behold, there stood up before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Uli, which called and said, Gabriel made this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. And when he was come, I was afraid, and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding, dark sentences shall stand up. and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted, and was sick certain days. Afterward I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. That reading serves to introduce the words of Mr. Judah Hunter to deliver his lecture to the title Alexander the Great Prophesied in the Bible.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now, our lecture for this evening deals with a man who was one of the greatest military commanders that the world has ever seen. A man who never lost a battle, who conquered one of the largest empires in human history in less than 10 years. But for our lecture this evening, we're not really going to focus on the remarkable strategies which this man employed, or the military precedents which he set. Because what truly enabled this man to succeed was that he was fulfilling a purpose which was set out for him in the Bible. And so this evening, what we're going to do is look at a number of prophecies in the Bible, prophecies which dictated aspects of the life of Alexander the Great before he was ever born. And we're going to see how he exactly fulfilled each and every one of these. Now, you might have noticed that in our reading for this evening in Daniel chapter 8, we actually had a direct reference to the king of Grecia in verse 21. We're going to come back to this shortly, but first turn with me to Daniel chapter 2. Now, in Daniel chapter 2, we have the story of what's known as Nebuchadnezzar's image. And this was actually a dream which Nebuchadnezzar had. And we can see this in verse 1. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians, and the astrologers, and the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And so Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and he calls together all his magicians and astrologers and sorcerers and the Chaldeans, and he gets them to try to interpret this dream which he's had. And so they're all standing there waiting for Nebuchadnezzar to tell them what dream he had, so that they could concoct some grandiose explanation that would make the king feel very wise and important. But instead, the king decides to do something different. Instead of telling them the dream and waiting for their interpretation, he commands them first to tell him what he'd dreamed, and then tell him what it meant. And he explains this in verse 9. He says, "But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof." And so King Nebuchadnezzar has come to realize that his wise men perhaps weren't quite so wise after all, that they'd been lying to him about the interpretation of his dreams. And he's not particularly happy about it. So he commands all the wise men in Babylon to be destroyed. Now, this included Daniel. And so when Daniel hears about this, he goes to Nebuchadnezzar and he asks for time to be able to interpret the dream. And we read in verse 17, "Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not be punished with, should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon." And God listens to Daniel, and he reveals the dream and the interpretation to him. But just have a look at what Daniel says in verse 20. "Daniel answered and said, Blessed be the name of God for ever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them that know understanding. So what we're seeing is that God removeth kings and setteth up kings. He changes the times and the season. And this is actually a consistent theme throughout the book of Daniel. In Daniel 4, verse 17, we read, "The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." And so, you see, everything we're going to look at tonight happens because God decided it would be so. Because God dictated the course of history. Because God has the prerogative and the supreme sovereignty to set up and abase any ruler at his will and pleasure. You see, prophecy is not a prediction of future events. God does not predict the future, he decides it. And so prophecy is God unveiling his plan for history, showing the course of events he has ordained and the outcomes that flow from his divine purpose. So back in Daniel 2, Daniel now shows King Nebuchadnezzar the dream in verse 31. He says, "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hand, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried of them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." And so the king saw this image made up from all these metals, and it was broken into pieces by this stone which came out of the mountain. And then that stone itself became a mountain to fill the whole earth. Now, our subject for this evening only really concerns the first part of this dream, the part where with the image and where all the metals are described. And Daniel interprets this in verse 36. He says, "This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold." And so what Daniel is saying is that this head of gold of this image actually represented the king of Babylon. But why gold? Well, we actually saw in Daniel's explanation. You see, he wasn't just showing flatteries upon the king of Babylon. Everything he said was true. The king of Babylon had absolute power. He was a king of kings. God had given into his hand almost all the people of the known world. Here's what Daniel says in chapter 5, verse 18 and 19, speaking to Nebuchadnezzar's successor. He says, "O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive, and whom he would, he set up, and whom he would, he put down." You see, this man was the absolute pinnacle of kingly power. He could do whatever he wanted. And so the metal gold was used as a fitting symbol for his power. But see what it says in verse 39. "And after thee shall arise another king inferior to the kingdom inferior to thee." And so the kingdom of Babylon would not last forever. There would be another kingdom, one described as inferior to Babylon. And that's just what happens. In 539 BC, Cyrus the Great diverted the Euphrates River around the city of Babylon, and led by Gobryas, one of his generals, the army marched up along the riverbed and took the city of Babylon in one night, and it fell to the Medo-Persian Empire. But why were they described as inferior? Well, you see, unlike Babylon, the kings of Media and Persia did not have absolute authority. They ruled under the restriction of law. And so rather than using the symbol of gold, instead God chooses an inferior metal. He uses the metal of silver to describe this nation. But then if we continue verse 39, "And another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And this is where we find our first reference to the Grecian Empire, because just like the kingdom of Babylon, just how the kingdom of Babylon came to an end, so too would the kingdom of Persia when Alexander the Great defeated Darius III and took over his kingdom. And now, of course, brass was a fitting symbol for the Grecian Empire, because the Greeks at the time were famous for their bronze armor. But note what it says, they shall bear rule over all the earth, the end of verse 39. You see, the Greek Empire was far larger than either the Roman or the Persian Empire, stretching from Macedonia in the west to India in the east, covering almost all of the known world of that time. And so we can see that just from this overview, right back in Daniel chapter 2, when the Babylonian Empire was still the dominant empire of the time, long before the Grecians came on the scene, God prophesied that the Greeks would be the ones to overtake the Persian Empire and become the dominant power of the world. But now just come forward briefly to Daniel chapter 7, because we're going to see a very similar story, however, and we're going to pick out a few details. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, we see this same progression of empires prophesied. However, this time, instead of using metals to describe the empires, the prophet uses animals. So in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 4, we have a lion, which answers to the empire of Babylon. And then in verse 5, we have a bear, which answers to the Medo-Persian Empire. But then we come to verse 6, where we have the leopard, which answers to the kingdom of Grecia. But just notice the details it provides. He says in verse 6, "After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given unto it." And so what we see with this leopard, the Grecian Empire, is that there's a number of fours associated. There's the four heads and the four wings. We're going to see these ideas come up again. So to save repeating myself, just tuck that idea of four away in the back of your mind, and we'll come back to it later. So now that you've got the four tucked away in your mind, let's come over to Daniel chapter 8. Now, we've already read through this once. It was our reading for this evening. And it's, of course, the story of the ram with the two horns. And then the goat comes along and he's got one horn and he defeats the ram. And then the horn's broken and then four more come up to replace it. So rather than read the whole story again, we're just going to pick out the details that we wish to consider. So in verse 3, we have a ram and he's waiting at a river. And there's two horns on the ram, and the second horn comes up after the first horn and it's higher than the first. And then in verse 4, we have the ram pushing west, north, and south. And then over in verse 5, we find the he-goat, and he comes from the west. And we're told he touched not the ground, and he had a notable horn between his eyes. There we go. Had a notable horn between his eyes. And in verse 6, he approaches the ram, who was already at the river, and we find that he's running. And he's in a fury. And then in verse 7, the he-goat is moved with choler, which means a hot, burning anger. And he smites the ram and breaks his two horns such that there was no power left in the ram, but it would still need to be stamped to the ground. And yet none would be able to deliver the ram. And then in verse 8, we find that the goat becomes very great. However, at the height of his greatness, the great horn is broken, and it is replaced with four horns, which are toward the four winds of heaven. Now, this is where the prophecy ceases to deal with Alexander the Great, or even the Grecian Empire. And so this evening, it's not our subject to consider the remainder of this prophecy. So we've collated all the key points from this prophecy here in Daniel chapter 8, as they concern Alexander the Great. And as we said earlier, we can add in the details that we saw from chapter 7. Because remember, we saw that the leopard had wings, but unlike any normal winged creature, he didn't just have two wings, he had four wings. And this gives us the idea of great speed in flight. And doesn't this remind us of the goat, which moved so fast against the ram that we're told in verse 5 that it touched not the ground? And of course, it wasn't just four wings. We saw the repetition of this idea of four wings and four heads. But isn't this the same idea that we saw come up in chapter 8 here with the four notable horns, which came up after the first horn was broken and pointed towards the four winds of heaven? But now, there's one other prophecy which I'd like to collect some details from before we begin to unpack all the meaning here from these chapters. And that prophecy is Daniel chapter 11. So just come over a few pages to that chapter. Now, for context, this prophecy was given during the reign of Cyrus. So our timeline for this prophecy begins there at the reign of Cyrus. And we'll see why that matters in a moment. So Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2, we read, "And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia." So there's a number of things to notice in this verse. Firstly, we're told that there would be three Persian kings after Cyrus, and before this fourth king that's mentioned, who would come up, and we're told that this fourth king would be far richer than the others, and that he would stir up all against the realm of Grecia. So to our catalogue of details, we can place in all of these events to line them up with the story of Daniel chapter 8. And now, of course, all of this occurs when the Persians are still rulers. So this will all occur before the events of chapter 8. And so we have the three kings after Cyrus. We have the fourth would be far richer than they all, and that he would stir up all against the realm of Grecia. But now back in chapter 11, have a look at verse 3. "And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those." But aren't these exactly the same ideas as we've already seen of the he-goat back in chapter 8? You see, this prophecy of the mighty king is actually talking about the very same person as the prophecy in chapter 8. You see, in verse 4, where it says, "When he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken." Well, that's the same as in chapter 8, when we found that the horn would be destroyed when it became strong. And when it says in verse 4, the kingdom would be divided towards the four winds of heaven, well, that's the same as in chapter 8, when we're told that the four horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. And we can also add to our list the point from verse 4 that the kingdom would not pass to his posterity, that it would be plucked up and given to others. And so now that we've collated all of these ideas together, let's come back to chapter 8 and begin to see what they all mean. So in chapter 8 and verse 20, we've already seen these words as we read them in our reading this evening, but just to reiterate, we're told plainly in verse 8 that the ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. So straight away, the ram is identified as the Medo-Persian Empire, and the two horns as the kings of Media and Persia. And then in verse 21 we read, "And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king." So now we can see, whenever we see in this chapter the he-goat, we know that it's a reference to the Grecian power. And whenever we see the notable horn, we know that it refers to the first king of the Grecian Empire, that is, none other than Alexander the Great. So with these details in mind, we can then take a look at the first events of this prophecy, which was the matter of the three kings and the fourth king found in Daniel chapter 11. Now, we're told that there would be three kings of Medo-Persia after Cyrus, but the fourth would be far richer than they all. Now, the first of these three kings was Cambyses II, the son of Cyrus, who unfortunately developed gangrene on his way to Syria and died without any children. And so after him came his younger brother Smerdis. And shortly after that, he was actually killed by Darius the Great, who claimed that the real Smerdis had actually been killed by his brother Cambyses many years prior, and that this man was actually an imposter called Gamata, who was pretending to be Smerdis. However, it's generally believed that this story was actually fabricated by Darius the Great in order to legitimize his seizure of power. So Darius was the third king, and during the beginning of his reign, he spent much time quelling rebellions throughout his kingdom. He was also known for establishing a common coinage system, building new roads throughout the empire, setting up a standard weights and measurement system. And by these efforts, he was quite effective in unifying the Persian Empire and promoting prosperity. He also introduced a new taxation system, and that led to the formation of banking systems throughout the entire empire. So Darius effectively took the Persian Empire from a group of conquered states to a unified, fully functioning empire. And it was at the height of this empire that the fourth king, Xerxes I, took the throne. And while Darius spent his reign building up and developing the wealth of this empire, Xerxes inherited it at its peak. And as a result, his riches far exceeded all the previous kings, just as we saw prophesied in Daniel chapter 11. Now, Xerxes' father, Darius, died while he was planning a second campaign against Grisha. And so when Xerxes ascended the throne, he began to do exactly the same. He amassed an army in order to invade Grisha. Now, there was something quite unique about the army which Xerxes amassed. And that is because it was comprised of a vast multitude of nationalities from all over the empire. In fact, the tomb of Xerxes has engravings of no less than 28 different ethnicities who were all part of his army. But isn't this exactly what we saw in Daniel chapter 11, where we're told that he would stir up all the realm against Grisha? Or as the NET has, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Grisha. Now, this invasion of Greece by the Persians around 480 BC was not entirely a success by the Persians. They succeeded in winning a few battles, they burned a few temples to the ground, and they tried to enslave some people. But in the end, the Grecians managed to retain their independence. But along with that, they retained a deep-rooted and searing hatred of the Persian Empire. And that was embedded into Greek culture for the next 100 or so years. And it was this hatred which caused Alexander the Great's father to begin preparations for an invasion of the Persian Empire before his death. Preparations which would eventually be carried out by Alexander the Great himself. And so with this build-up and the rising tensions between the two powers, we come to the events of chapter 8. Now, we saw that there were two horns on the ram, which represented the Median and the Persian kings. And we saw that one horn came up second, but that horn was higher than the first horn. And this is a reference to the fact that the kingdom was initially ruled over by the Medes, but that this rulership eventually passed to the Persians, who ended up being far greater than the Medes. So in verse 4, when we find the ram... Now, in verse 4, we find that the ram pushed west, north, and south. And this is actually a reference to the extent of the Persian Empire, because Persia was an eastern nation. And so when it built up its empire, it went north, it went west, and it went south. Now, in verse 5, we find the he-goat coming against the Persian Empire. Now, after ascending the throne, Alexander the Great first went around subduing the nations around him in order to maintain his throne and to stabilize his kingdom. He went subduing the Thracians and the Illyrians and the Thebans, and that established a western front to his kingdom in order to prepare for his invasion toward the east, toward Persia. And so once his kingdom's been established, once all these rebellions and these western nations have been subdued, he then moves east. And so what that means is that from the perspective of the ram in this vision, the he-goat is coming from the west. And that's exactly what we see in this chapter. Alexander the Great came from the west, from Greece. And so we have the ram, or the Persians, in the east, and the goat, representing the Grecians, in the west. Now, when we look at the battles between Alexander the Great and the Persian Empire, the first major battle was the Battle of Granicus, and this took place at the river Granicus. Now, the Persians, being the defenders, set up a strategic location just over the banks of the Granicus River and waited for Alexander the Great to arrive. Now, in the second major battle, the Battle of Issus, the Persians again, the defenders, took up a strategic position on the other side of the Pinarus River and waited for Alexander the Great and the Macedonian army to arrive. In the third and final major battle between the Persians and Alexander the Great, the Battle of Gargamela, the Persians took up a strategic position near the watercourses in the plains of Gargamela and waited for Alexander the Great to arrive. But isn't this exactly what we see in Daniel chapter 8? Verse 3, it reads, "Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram." And again in verse 6, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river. And so you see, it was prophesied that the Persians would utilize the rivers as a strategic aid in their battles. They would stand or wait on the other side of the river for Alexander the Great and his army to arrive. Now, we saw that the goat was running, that he was moving so fast that he didn't touch the ground. And we saw the imagery of the four wings on the leopard representing the rapid movement of this man in setting up his empire. And this was actually one of the more remarkable characteristics of the campaign of Alexander the Great. He was able to defeat the Persian Empire and set up his own empire spanning from India to Macedonia in less than 10 years. Now, to put that into perspective, the Babylonian Empire took between 80 and 100 years to set up, and the Persian Empire took over 200. So the 10 years of Alexander the Great is actually quite a remarkable feat. But you'll notice also in verse 6 that we saw that the goat ran in fury. And again in verse 7, the goat was moved with choler, or hot, burning rage, toward the ram. But isn't this exactly what we saw earlier? What was it that caused the invasion to take place in the first place? Was it not the deep-rooted hatred of the Greeks and Macedonians toward the Persian Empire, the hatred which was caused by the invasion of Xerxes I back in Daniel chapter 11? Now, after Alexander the Great defeated Darius III at the Battle of Gargamela, the Persian Empire was effectively at an end. Not long after this, Darius was actually captured, taken prisoner by Bessus, one of his province rulers, before being executed as Alexander approached. Bessus then attempted to set himself up as the next king of the Persian Empire and set about leading a bunch of guerrilla campaigns against Alexander the Great in an attempt to save the empire, but he was eventually betrayed and executed. But these events fit exactly what was prophesied in verse 7. Have a look at the order of events. First, the horns, representing the kings, are broken, and this lines up with the death of Darius. However, after this, the empire still needed to be stamped out, in spite of efforts to deliver it out of the hand of Alexander the Great. As we saw, this represents the efforts of Bessus and his guerrilla tactics to deliver the Persian Empire, out of the hand of Alexander the Great. And so, having conquered the Persian Empire, Alexander then further extends his campaign into India and extends his empire. However, not long after this, at the height of his power, at the age of 32, he dies. But isn't this exactly what we saw prophesied? You see, we saw in verse 8 that when the he-goat was strong, the great horn, which represented Alexander the Great, would be broken. Now, upon the death of Alexander the Great, there was no clear successor to the throne. However, the generals united under two main parties, behind two potential candidates. On the one hand, there was a party led by a general named Predicus, who believed that the empire should wait for the birth of Alexander the Great's unborn son. And there was another party led by a man named Malega, who believed that the empire should appoint Aridaeus, Alexander's mentally disabled half-brother, as the ruler. Eventually, they struck a compromise whereby Aridaeus and Alexander's unborn son would co-rule, with Predicus and Malega acting as co-regents. However, this arrangement didn't last for very long, because Predicus, who really had more influence of the two, eventually had Malega and all of his supporters killed, and he assumed full control of himself. And then he sets up all of the generals who'd supported him as rulers of provinces, as administrators throughout the empire. However, this eventually just devolves into a power struggle itself, because each of these generals used the province they ruled over as a base to try to gain more power and to try to usurp all the other rulers. And these generals became known as the Diadochi, which is an ancient Greek name meaning the successors. Now, there were five wars of the Diadochi. These were called the First War of the Diadochi, and the Second War of the Diadochi, and the Third War of the Diadochi, and the War of Babylon, and the Fourth War of the Diadochi. Now, in the First War, the centralized power under Predicus comes to an end when Predicus is assassinated, which, from the point of view of stabilizing the empire, this essentially ended that idea. There would now be no unifying party in the empire that Alexander the Great had built. And so the Diadochi essentially descends into chaos from this point. Now, by the end of the Second War of the Diadochi, four main figures dominated the scene. There was Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Antigonus. Now, at this stage, Antigonus was by far the most powerful. And so the other three, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Ptolemy, decide that they need to do something about it. So they form an alliance together and they attack Antigonus. Now, there was a man under Ptolemy named Seleucus, who had once been the ruler of the province of Babylon. However, Antigonus had come along and kicked him out, and he'd fled over to Ptolemy in Egypt. However, now that Ptolemy was in an alliance against Antigonus, he gives Seleucus backing to go and take back his province over in Babylon, and he does just that. However, this somewhat upsets Antigonus because he wanted to keep his province, and so Antigonus comes along and tries to stop Seleucus from taking the province of Babylon. However, he fails, and Seleucus manages to retain that. Now, it was around this time that Cassander murders Alexander the Fourth, who was the son of Alexander the Great. And at this stage, he was still the king, but really in name only. The empire was ruled by the generals. Now, Antigonus was not particularly happy that Seleucus had managed to take away the province of Babylon and stop him taking it back. And so there was a rising conflict between the two, and this came to a head in the Battle of Ipsus in 301 BC, when Antigonus was slain and Seleucus manages to take control of the territory belonging to Antigonus. And so after the final war of the Diadochi, the remnants of Alexander the Great's empire stabilizes under four central rulers. There was Cassander to the west, controlling Macedonia and mainland Greece. There was Lysimachus to the north, controlling Thrace and Western Asia Minor. There was Seleucus to the east, controlling Babylon and Persia, and there was Ptolemy to the south, controlling Egypt. And so the remaining details of the prophecy concerning Alexander the Great came to pass. Upon his death, his kingdom was broken up. It was divided towards the four winds of heaven, and it did not pass to his posterity. And so we can see that this outline of the life of Alexander the Great came to pass, just as God had dictated and determined long before. But just turn over to Ezekiel chapter 26, because there's one other prophecy I'd like to consider this evening. Now, in Ezekiel 26, we're going to see that not only was the general skeleton, the outline of Alexander's life, dictated by prophecy, but also in some cases the very details regarding how he would conquer a city. Now, in Ezekiel 26, we have the prophecy of the destruction of Tyre. Now, we're not going to deal with this chapter in a large amount of detail because most of it doesn't actually concern Alexander the Great. However, the first thing to note is in verse 3. God says, "Behold, I am against thee, O Tyrus, and will cause many nations to come up against thee, as the sea causeth his waves to come up." And so God says that not just one nation, but many would come up against Tyre to destroy it. And we can see this in the pronoun used in verse 4. "And they shall destroy the walls of Tyrus and break down her towers." So there were to be multiple nations who would come up against this city. But just take note of that pronoun, because we find in verse 7 that the prophecy becomes more specific. "Thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will bring upon Tyrus Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, a king of kings from the north." And so one of these nations is identified for us, as the nation of Babylon, and is commanded here by Nebuchadnezzar. But just notice the pronoun used in verse 8. It says, "He shall slay with the sword thy daughters in the field. He shall make a fort against thee." Verse 9, "He shall set engines of war against thy walls. With his axes he shall break down thy towers." And again in verse 10, "his horses." And later in the verse, "when he shall enter into thy gates, as men enter into a city wherein is made a breach." And verse 11, "when the hooves of his horses," sorry, "with the hooves of his horses shall he tread down all their streets. He shall slay thy people with the sword." And so we can see that all these pronouns are in the singular. They are not the "they" of verse 4. This is simply one of the nations. This is only Babylon. And what we're being told is that there would be more nations to come. It wouldn't just be Babylon. But just notice what it was that the king of Babylon would do. Verse 8, "he would make a fort and cast a mount against the city." Verse 9, "he would bring engines of war against the walls and break down the towers." Verse 10, "he would enter into the city as through a breach." You see, this was to be a siege. And history does, in fact, record a 13-year-long siege by Nebuchadnezzar on Tyrus from BC 586 to 573. And just as we have prophesied here, the city was plundered and many people were slain. But while Nebuchadnezzar succeeded in breaching the mainland city of Tyre, there was an island stronghold just off the coast of Tyre, about a kilometre away, which he failed to capture. And so eventually Nebuchadnezzar withdrew from the city, leaving the mainland city in rubble. But now just have a look at verse 12, because, well, suddenly the pronouns shift. It says, "and they shall make a spoil of thy riches, and make a prey of thy merchandise. And they shall break down thy walls and destroy the pleasant houses. And they shall lay thy stones and thy timber and thy dust in the midst of the water." And so here we find that another nation, a second nation, would come up against Tyre. And this second nation has now entered the picture, because we saw that verse 3 specified more than one nation. It said many nations. However, up until this point, there had only been one nation, only Babylon, and only the singular pronoun "he" had been used. But now in verse 12, there's another nation. And so to illustrate this, the pronoun shifts from "he" to "they." But just have a look at what this nation was going to do. Now, the first two items are relatively standard siege procedure. They would make a spoil of the riches. They would break down the walls. And this is generally what happened in a siege. But just have a look at the third item. "They shall lay thy stones and thy timber and thy dust in the midst of the water." Now, this was not common siege practice of the day. It was unusual for a nation to come and conquer a city and then pick up every scrap of that city and carry it to the nearest water source and dump it in. They didn't generally bother to clean up after themselves. And so we might find this to be a bit of an odd prophetic statement. But just as we saw in the beginning of our lecture, prophecy is the unveiling of God's purpose, of what God will cause to happen. And so stating that this nation would cast the stones and the timber and the dust of Tyrus into the water is not an odd prediction. It was a demonstration of God's supreme control over the course of history to cause events to happen which would seem unlikely in the natural order. Now, as you might have guessed, this nation which fulfilled this prophecy was none other than the Grecian Empire under the leadership of Alexander the Great. Now, as Alexander made his way down the Mediterranean coastline, he offered terms of surrender to all the cities, promising that if they delivered their city over peacefully, he would spare their lives and their property. And Tyre was no exception. Alexander the Great offered them terms of surrender, which they initially accepted. However, God had dictated that this would not be how the matter ended. And so, as part of the terms of the surrender, Alexander the Great wished to do a sacrifice in the temple of Heracles, which was on the island. And the Tyrians said, "Well, oh, no, no, you can't do that. And there's a temple on the mainland. How about you go and sacrifice at that temple instead?" Now, of course, this isn't the sort of thing you go around saying to people like Alexander the Great. And he was rather unhappy by their refusal. And so he did the only logical thing when someone has refused to allow you on their islands to sacrifice to the god Heracles. He picked up the entire mainland city, which was still a pile of rubble, and threw it into the sea to build a causeway out to the city of Tyre. He then laid siege to the city, beat down the walls with battering rams, butchered the inhabitants, plundered their possessions, and then he went into the temple of Heracles to offer his sacrifice. And so every word of the prophecy in Ezekiel has come to pass, right down to the method by which Alexander the Great would conquer the city. And of course, we saw that this was not what Alexander wanted to do. He initially tried to conquer the city peacefully. However, God had dictated exactly what would happen and put in place the events to ensure that his plan and purpose came to pass. Now, tonight we've considered the life of a man who, by human standards, was very great. But in a number of ways, he was quite like another man, Jesus Christ, who was the greatest man to have ever lived. Both these men died at around the age of 33. And yet, while Alexander the Great conquered the known world, Jesus Christ defeated his nature, sin in the flesh, the greatest enemy, and was raised to life again by God, exalted into heaven, and given all power in heaven and earth. In Mark 8, verse 36, Christ spoke these words, "For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" And Alexander the Great did just that. He conquered the known world. He was a king of one of the greatest empires to have ever existed. And just 1 month before his 33rd birthday, he died and left it all behind, never to see the light of day again. And in a sense, ladies and gentlemen, we have a choice before us to choose between these two classes of outcomes. We can either choose to pursue riches and honor and pleasure from this world, a choice which will end in our death with no hope of the future. Or we can choose to serve God, to repent from our old way of life, to be baptized, to find out what God would have us to do, and to strive to live our lives accordingly, and to have a hope of resurrection and eternal life when Jesus Christ returns to the earth. Now we've seen, through the prophecies of Alexander the Great, that God controls the course of history, that he has a purpose which he reveals through prophecy, and that in his supreme power and prerogative, he can cause events to transpire exactly as he sees fit. And what he has said will, without any doubt, come to pass. And God has said that his Son, Jesus Christ, will return to the earth, that he will judge the world and give reward to those who have served him. And so the question for us becomes, the question for you and the question for me, is what will your choice be?